Okay. Can we start? Yeah. Okay. So thanks for turning up. It's a lovely day outside, and it's a Friday afternoon. So I imagine it is a wee bit of a wrench to come into a lecture theatre at this time of day, at this time of the week, with this kind of weather. But thanks for coming. What I want to talk about today is something that's a little bit more sophisticated than we've seen before in terms of proofs. So remember, last time when I was talking, then I gave you a particular way of proving a formula. And what happened with that was that you took an expression in propositional logic and you wanted to know whether it was true or false. Does this thing hold or does it not? And then what you did was you exhaustively considered all the truth values, and then you could give an answer. That was basically the name of the game. Oh, sorry, this is a little... Microphones, is that a little better, actually? Sounds a little better to me, not so... It's still a little echoey, actually. The acoustics are a little strange here, actually. Feels odd. That's a little better, I think, right? I have no idea what I did, but it seems to be a little bit better. No? Still terrible. Further away is maybe good. That better? No, but this one is on, but it was on last time as well. That better? No. It's still echoing. Let's try with just that one. Sorry about this. This doesn't usually happen. Just with this one. Is that better? Yeah. Okay. We'll stick with this one, and I'll try and. I'll have to be a little bit more static. I'll have to stay close to it. Okay, so I was saying we'll try a slightly more sophisticated form of proof. As usual, I'll be doing it by giving you a little problem, actually two problems at the very beginning, and then we'll come back to them at the end. And in the middle, you get a little bit more formal machinery. Okay, so first problem we're going to look at is to do with databases. You already kind of got the plot. I try to use examples that come from all sorts of different places through here. This one is yet another area. So databases are, of course, hugely important to everything you do. An awful lot of the stuff that you use is at some point driven off a database. And one of the standard problems that people want to tackle with databases is a database join. So imagine here you have a database. It's a university database. So actually, you have two databases. One is for employees, and so you have a table. It's normally the way you think about a database. And in the table, you have various columns, and you have a row for each individual in the column. So here we have employees, and each employee has a name and has an ID number. So Dave is ID 2345. Actually, that's not my real employee ID, but yeah, it might have been. And so on it goes. So here we have four people with their employee IDs. And then somewhere else in the university has many, many, many different databases, more than you would believe. Somewhere else it has a lecturer database, and again, that has names, and it has the sex of the person and their age, let's say. And then a typical thing you might want to do is you want to actually take the lecturers, all of the lecturers who have the names the same as the employee names, and have ages below 50 or some other constraint, and then you want to construct this database, which is the new database, that has their name, their sex, their age. Actually, you probably don't need to duplicate the name I have here, and the ID. Okay, so it's basically this table plus this table joined together to give you a new table, given these constraints. That's database join. Tell me the constraints. This is a specification for the join. This is what that specification takes, and this is what it produces. Right. So that's one problem that we're going to solve. Here's another completely different problem. I love to give completely different problems in these lectures, just to give you an idea of the breadth. English grammar. So lots and lots of people spend an awful lot of time worrying about how language is structured. Now, actually, it's a huge and very deep subject, and you're lucky if you're interested in that kind of thing in later years. You're lucky because you've got one of the biggest centers for that kind of research sitting about 50 yards away in that direction. So lots and lots of things that people worry about there, but one thing people worry about is just grammars, actually not just for English language, for natural language, but also for formal languages. One way of thinking about grammar is in terms of grammar rules. So here's the world's simplest English grammar. Of course, it's not a very good English grammar, but anyway. This one says a sentence will be well-formed with respect to the grammar if it contains a noun phrase followed by a verb phrase. This one says a noun phrase is well-formed if it has a noun in it or it has a determiner followed by a noun. This rule says a verb phrase is well formed if it's just a verb or if it's a verb followed by a noun phrase. Right? You get the idea. These are rules, so you describe the rules that specify your grammar. Okay. And often what people then do is they use this to be able to parse sentences, to be able to say, here's a sentence, does it conform, is it English according to the rules of my English grammar, or is it something else? So here's a sequence, says Dave bites the dust, and you can check this and see that it conforms, because if that's a sentence, so that's the sentence, then it has to consist of a noun phrase followed by a verb phrase, a noun phrase followed by a verb phrase. A noun phrase can just be a noun, that's allowed, so Dave is okay. A verb phrase can be a verb followed by, a verb followed by a noun phrase, right? Verb followed by noun phrase. So bites is a verb. And now a noun phrase can be, let's see, a determiner followed by noun. That is a determiner. Noun is dust. And now we've satisfied the rules, nothing left over. So that is indeed well formed with respect to this particular grammar. Okay? So what we're going to do at the end is go through how to formalize these things and then deal with them as computational problems. But before we do that, I have to give you some more notation. Sorry for giving you even more notation. There is just kind of no way to avoid having to give you quite a lot of notation at the beginning of the course. I wish I didn't have to, but I do. Because otherwise, there's no way I can talk about anything formally. So when I give you this notation, I'm also giving you a different way of thinking about how to do a proof. So you're getting two things kind of at once. And the way we're going to think about proofs is different from the way we thought about truth tables, because now we're going to think about proofs as little bits of machinery, where what you do is you describe the set of axioms that you believe to be true about the problem you're dealing with, and then what your proof does is derive things that are true with respect to that set of axioms. You'll see in a moment the machinery that we're going to use to run that little mechanism. And so this little turns, what's often called a turnstile here, this funny looking thing here, let's just keep calling it a turnstile because that's what it looks like. All it's doing is separating off your set of axioms, which is this thing I've written in green, F. So it can be any set of axioms from the thing that you want to prove, which is the A there. So what this is really saying is If this is true, then I could prove the A from whatever is inside that set F. Okay, that's what it means. And then F is going to be some sequence of expressions. The expressions are going to be in the propositional logic that you saw before. So that's not new notation. Okay. I have to give you two more things in order to do the things that I want to do later. One is this operator, this bar operator, which is going to add A to the set of expressions to make a larger sequence. Let me just be completely clear about that one. So if I want to add the proposition A, suppose I have a set of things. A implies B, B implies C. And I want to add some other expression, let's say A in there. I can write A, this I'll just call bar. That's how I'll verbalize that expression. And then A, B, B, C. In other words, this same list, this same sequence here is in here with this bar, then that's just the same as writing A bar B, B bar C. Okay? All this does is just stuff something on the front of one of these sequences. And I use that, but there's lots of different ways. Again, there's lots of different notations for doing this. I use that particular notation because I'm just a dyed-in-the-wool logic programmer, and logic programmers use that kind of notation, but it doesn't really matter. This operator is just membership. So this is true if this element A appears in this set. So for example, where's my chalk? A is in that set, or A implies B is in that set, right? Just pulls out the element set. So let us. Okay, happy with all of that. A bit more notation, but it's not too overwhelming, I hope. Right. Now, I'm giving you a set of proof rules. I've duplicated them down in chalk down on the board here for reasons that will become apparent later. Now what I'm going to do is to describe to you a particular way of doing proofs from this. And there's many, many different... this is the particular sort of system I'm using here is a sequent calculus. There are many, many variants of sequent calculus that you can use. And I'll talk a little bit later about how you choose the particular proof rules that you use. I've chosen this particular set simply because it links on to some of the things that I'm going to be doing a bit later in the sequence of lectures where I talk about computations and so on. It suits what I'm coming on to later. But I can't tell you why until you see what happens later, in subsequent lectures. So the way you think about proofs is you have the proof that you want to do, that's in this column here, and then you have the things that you're obliged to do in order to complete that proof. So basically, one way of thinking about it is you have a proof that you want to do that's maybe looks quite complicated, okay, some complicated thing you want to prove. What these guys are going to do, which each row in this table is going to do, is it's going to give you a way of decomposing the proof into something that you hope is going to be a simpler proof and is one that is going to lead to a proof that actually works. The kind of most elementary step that you can take in a proof, what's the simplest way that you can prove some expression from a set of axioms? Well, it's when it appears in the set of axioms. So if I say, given this set here, A implies B, B implies C, can I prove A? Then obviously I can, because A is there, right? So it's the most trivial step that you can take. So actually later as we go on through, we'll see that that's always where you end up. Wherever you decompose one of these proofs, making it simpler and simpler, you always end up, you know, at every step in that decomposition with one of these. It appears in my set of axioms. All right. And all of these other ones are really, they're really giving you a route to that end point. And that way your proof will terminate. So let's just go through them, and I'll give you the intuitions for them. So, and all the connectives are just the same as the logical connectives you've seen before. So nothing new in terms of the connectives inside. The bit that's new is the proof machinery, not the form of the expressions. So here we have A and B. So if I want to prove A and B for some set of axioms, then what I need to do is to prove A, and then separately prove A, prove B from the same set of axioms, right? Another way that people often describe these kind of proofs are natural deduction proofs. And the reason they're called natural deduction proofs is they feel quite natural a lot of the time. Not always, but a lot of the time. So if I want to prove A or B from some set of axioms, it's sufficient just to prove A, right? If I want to prove A or B from some set of axioms, it's sufficient to prove B. I don't have to prove both A and B like I have to do for AND. Here's a slightly more complicated one. So if I want to prove a proof of something C, and I've got A or B is in my set of axioms, so either one or both might be true, then to prove C, given that A or B is in the set of axioms, I need to prove, if I assume A is in my set of axioms, so I add in A, sneak in A, and prove C, and separately, now notice that these are completely separate, separately I sneak in B, and I can prove C from the set of axioms, then I have a proof of C, because it doesn't matter whether I assumed A or whether I assumed B, I still get C. Happy with that one? Yes.
And why did you need to sneak in A or B for origin members?
But A itself isn't known. So what we know here from the set of axioms is that A or B, but we don't know which. And so then what I do is I separately assume A and separately assume B. Yeah, a good question. Right? Happy with that? It's actually a little bit more subtle than the ones we've had before, and it's important you understand what we're doing. Actually, another way of getting you the same kind of, a similar kind of thing, here's another one where we sneak in an axiom into the axiom set. So suppose we want to prove that A implies B from my set of axioms. Well, I can assume A, so I sneak it into the set of axioms. Just say, let's assume it that A is true. We don't know it's true. Let's assume it is. If I assume it is, can I prove B? If I can, then A must imply B, because when I stick it into my set of axioms, I get B out. So that's another one where what we're doing by just adding this element in is essentially making an assumption. It's a bit like, it does have a kind of natural appeal, right? So quite often in human argument you will say, well, but assuming blah, 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 wouldn't this be true? And then you use that to build up some other part of your argument, right? But you have to be able to discharge the assumption because the assumption must be one that is legitimately true. So here we know A or B, therefore it's legitimate to try a proof where we assume A and separately assume B. That is strong enough to give us the proof based on the evidence that we had from A or B. Okay, so it's a little bit complicated, but you get the idea, I hope. Let me show you a little bit about how it's different from a truth table. And this will be the first little proof that we do. Now look, this one looks a little complicated. I just wanted to show you, to give you an idea of why it's different from truth tables. And I should say, I'm going to have to start using things that are a bit more structured than just propositions now. Because actually, really, really where these sequent calculus proofs come into their own, in my view, is where you start dealing with structures, because you can really see that they're doing some work for you. So I have to go a little bit beyond the propositional to explain that to you. Okay, so suppose we have this set of axioms. So we want to prove P of F of A. Doesn't really matter what the Fs are. It's just a big structured thing. And I know that P of A is true. And I know that if P of X is true, then P of F of X is true. Okay? And that's quite difficult to do from a truth table, because we've got variables in there, and it's hard to write down all the rows for these things in a truth table. Have a try. See how it goes. But you can quite easily prove it with a natural deduction proof. Here we go. We want to prove, here's my set of axioms, P of A, and P of X implies P of F of X. I want to prove P of F of A. So, what I do is I say, okay, I've got PX implies P of F of X in here, right? So it's actually, this might help. Okay, where are we? That one. Okay, so this one says I can prove something from my set of axioms if I have the implication in my set of axioms, and then I can prove the precondition in the implication, the bit on the left-hand side of the implication. Okay, so I've got P of x if P of f of x in here. Actually, the complicated bit here is I have to, I'm matching the P of f of x to P of f of a. So there it is. And then I end up with the x being the thing inside, right? Just the f of a, the smaller structure inside. This is going a little bit beyond where you'd ever be with propositional logic, but I think it's a nice thing just to be able to see. Actually, if you're a logic programmer, and we will touch a little bit on logic programming later, then it's the sort of thing that you do all the time, decomposing structures in this kind of way. So anyway, so then what we've got is we've got P of F of A implies P of F of A. F of A is inside here, matching that guy to the F of X here. And then I need to do a proof that P of F of A is implied by my original set of axioms. That's what this proof rule said I had to do. But the nice thing is I'm now tackling a slightly simpler problem because this is a slightly smaller structure. Okay? So let's tackle that slightly simpler problem, and I do it exactly the same way, actually. So because I've got inside this axiom yet another one, the same one of these. This is still true. So now I can say P of F of A matching X to A here. Then I've got P of A if P of F of A is in here. Whoop. And now I want to be able to prove something even simpler. P of A from P of A and the implication. And that guy is going to be real simple because I only need this one to do it. And I'm done. Right? See, that's quite a lot in that one. I mean, some point, you could, nice silence there where people absorbed that. So what we're really, let's go back through it. Because it's a good one to look at. Don't let it scare you, because there's an awful lot of structural stuff going on. But all you need to do is keep your eye on the recursion here. Somebody asked a question.
What is it called again?
Which one?
When you have
that one?
Yeah.
Oh, so that's just separating the elements of the sequence. Yeah. Let me go. But let's take a bit of time.
No,
Yeah. Let's take a bit of time over this one, just so you feel completely comfortable with it, because I think it will help you a lot in understanding the natural deduction proofs and why they work. So here's what we want to be able to prove. So here are my axioms. I tell you, it's a bit abstract and mathematical, but you could map it onto some other thing that has sounds more usual, but it doesn't matter. So I say P of A is true, and it's also true that P of anything implies P of F of whatever that thing is, right? That's what I tell you about the world, okay? And that's your whole set that you need to know describing the problem. And then I ask, for given that, can I prove P of F of A? That's what I want to know. Can I show this thing from all of this, given my proof rules that I've got here? And the answer is yes, which I've shown you. And the trick that I'm doing is I'm always applying this one. I'm only really using one proof rule until the very end when I use this, the trivial one, just to decompose it. And what I'm using is this implication from f of something given something smaller, the thing inside the f. So it's a bit like when I'm doing this, what I'm really, it's almost like looking inside a box, right? I keep looking inside the box to find something smaller. That's what I'm doing. And as I go back through the implication. Okay, so I set it up like this. This is exactly the same as this, and this tree is showing you the way I decompose the problem. So what people way people describe this tree is as a proof tree. And these bits here, as it happens, are the bits where I'm just looking in the set of axioms. They're the membership bits. Right, so this is the bit where I look up the implication, and I'm matching it on there. And then I have the bit where I'm doing the problem decomposition on the smaller bit. And always what I'm doing is just choosing the proof rule, saying, I'm doing this particular one in this case. What do I need to, this one, in this particular case, do this bit, and then I do this bit. That's all. Just following the proof rules through. Okay. So, are these guys really better than truth tables or not? So, and the answer is sort of. For this particular set of proof rules, I mean. So, we certainly can deal with proofs that truth tables can't handle. But the particular ones I gave you, that's this set that I've written down here and the set that was on the previous slide, actually aren't necessarily the set of proof rules that you'd ideally want to use. The ones I'm using, because I have something in mind for them later on. But if you try to prove something like not P and not P, using that's have a go, actually, later on when you've got a bit more experience using things like this, have a go trying to solve something like this. Actually, you won't be able to solve that. We can't solve things like this either. There are certain kinds of proofs that you might find easy to do with a proof table that you won't be able to do with this particular set of proof rules. With let me be completely clear, with that particular set. And the reason why is because although I would claim that that particular set is sound, it's not complete. So let me explain to you what I mean by soundness and completeness. So when you look at a set of proof rules like this, then you think, what is it that I should be able legitimately to derive, given what I understand by and or an implication? If you want to go back to your basic understanding of and or an implication, you need to look no further than your truth tables, right? So then the question is it sound? Are there things that that system of proof rules could derive that actually shouldn't logically be implied? That I shouldn't infer? If so, then it's not sound. There are some things that I could infer that don't logically follow from the set of axioms. I have an unsound set of proof rules then. I would claim that the proof set of proof rules that I've given you, I'm not going to prove that for you here, but I claim that they are sound. Right. Prove me wrong. Then the next question is it complete? And that's a different question. So that means that for all the things that I could legitimately, logically imply from my set of axioms, can I derive them all? And I would claim that the set of proof rules I just gave you is not complete. And so the two examples I gave you are examples that you cannot derive. Okay, so to show that something is not complete, you would look for a counterexample like that. So those are the kind of those are sort of like absolutes. You look at the set of proof rules and you say, is it sound? Is it complete? But there's another slightly more subtle notion, which is it decidable? By which we mean, is there some mechanism that we could use to always decide whether something is true or false in that, given that particular logical system? Which is not quite the same as in the abstract sense we can always derive everything that would logically follow. Different to say, in theory, we could always logically derive all of the legitimate consequences from some set of axioms, as opposed to saying, I can give you the mechanism that will do it. Okay. We're not going to spend a lot of time in this course talking about soundness and completeness and decidability. We're going to be doing much more mechanical things, but those issues are always with us. Okay, so now I'm going to give you a larger proof tree, and let's see how you cope with this one. This is your very first proof tree, and the good news is I've stopped talking about things with variables in them and structures to match. So you can kind of forget about all of that now. If the slide that I gave you with the proof tree with the variables and the structures in it just kind of made your brain turn to jelly, then just forget about that experience. And this one won't, because it's all propositional. And actually, I'm already abusing my own notation here, because these things are uppercase, and that really means they're. I usually reserve uppercase letters for variables, but here they're propositions. So sorry about that. So this says B implies C. From the axiom B implies C. So I only have one axiom to deal with. Then I can prove that A or B implies A or C. Well, hey, right? So which I. At least to me, isn't immediately obvious, right? Okay, so it's a reasonably challenging thing to do. Actually, while we're doing, how much time have we got? Yeah, we got a bit of time. Take a little bit of time and think. Here are, whoops, that could be two. Right, you can see the proof rules. I've written them here. Maybe not in very good handwriting, but they're written here. What do you think would be the first proof rule you'd apply? You don't need to shout it around. Just give it a little bit of thought, just to keep your brain working on this thing, so that it doesn't. Oh yes. Let's try. That's the one I'm going to use. You might use the other one. Actually, I don't know what happens if you use that one. I don't know. That's actually one thing about these proof trees. There's different. What would be lovely would be if there was always at every point, and in a moment I'll talk to you about strategy for trying to build up these proof trees, so don't worry about it quite yet. But the world would be lovely if there was always exactly one way at every point to build up one of these proof trees. Unfortunately, usually not. Usually you have a choice. And actually, some of the choices give you, you have one choice, another choice, and each one will give you a proof. So it's not as if, even as if you can say, well, it's always one that will succeed. So that does make it a lot difficult sometimes to do the choice. So what the choice I've made here is to do the one that follows back the implication and puts it in here, which is this one. All right, one right at the bottom. So this one says, I've got an implication here. If A or B is true, then I can prove A or C. So that's the implication. Given that I've got an implication to prove, then a choice is to take this, stuff it in as a precondition. So now I'm assuming A or B, show that A or C follows. I'm using this one, right? Happy with that step? Yes? Completely happy. I want you to be completely happy with this step. You're happy with this step. Good. Oh, nice to keep people happy. Right. Next step. I'm using this guy. Okay. The reason I'm doing that is because I just stuck in A or B as an assumption. So my thinking at this point is, I just stuck in A or B as an assumption, and I have a proof rule that's going to allow me to reason given that assumption. Let's go. Let's make use of that assumption if we can. So I'm using this rule. So I say A or B is in F. A or B is in there. You can see it. There it is. And then what I do is I show separately, that's what this guy says, separately, the left-hand side gives me the conclusion and the right-hand side gives me the conclusion. So I put in the left-hand side, A, and then in the other subproof I put in the B. So I have two, I've simplified the problem a little bit, but I now have more work to do. I now have two subproofs that I have to do, right? So let's take, I can't remember which one I now do. I'll just step through it. That one. Okay, so given this one, I want to prove A or C. And the good news is I've got A in there. So, but if I want to prove A or B, it's sufficient to prove the left-hand side, which I already got. So there you go. Trivially, it's there. So A is in that set. Bingo. And then I move on to this guy. So now I have to prove A or C. And I've chosen the right-hand side here. So I'm using now this rule. It says I can take the right-hand side and prove it, right? Still with me, by the way. I'm not going too fast. Still with me? Happy? Still on board? Good. So now I want to do this side. Actually, let me stop while you're kind of taking this in. Which rule do you think I should use now? Want to prove C, and I've got all of this stuff. Which one?
I'm on second to last.
Second last. Bingo, second last. So I can prove C if I've got B implies C in my set. There it is. And then what I want to do is prove B. So I want to prove B from all of this. And of course it's looking good now, because that's immediate. Feel more comfortable with that one than you did with the last proof, right? Because I didn't turn your brain to jelly with the structures in the middle. and all that funny recursive stuff. Have you done recursion yet in functional programming? No. Wow, I beat Phil Wardlow to recursion. That's good. That doesn't usually happen. I'll bet I can't beat him explaining it.
You need to prove both sides of that. You need to prove for A and C.
Where?
See when you split it into B.
This bit here.
Yeah, and then you proved it for A, and you proved it for C.
Good question. And the answer is no. Because the split is on the assumption that I'm making. But it's good you ask, because it's an important distinction to make. And it is a little bit confusing. So A or C is just a structure, right, that I want to prove. So it doesn't this could be even more complicated than that if I want. And it would make no difference to my choice here, because what's going on here is I'm saying A or B is known. I've got it in my set of axes. I know that A or B must be true, and therefore I just need to do a separate subproof, assuming A and assuming B. And the A or C bit is still the same thing I want to prove in both cases. I must keep this thing constant here, because I still want to prove it, regardless of which choice I make about A or B. That's the crucial thing. So I said a little bit now, but you get quite a bit of practice doing these kinds of things in tutorials. You also get quite a lot of practice exercises in WebCT if the tutorials aren't enough. And by the way, I don't know whether it'll be Thursday or Friday lecture next week. I'll get Shari Arbajani, who's the teaching assistant on this course, to come in and show you a little bit of WebCT if you're not familiar with it. So there'll be some point where we'll explain all of that. But it is, what I've given you here is really quite a lot of notation. And I've given you a couple of examples of doing proofs with this. So if you're a normal person, I suspect, at this point, what I'm hoping is that you kind of roughly understand what we're about here, and you roughly understand what the process of doing these sequent calculus proofs is. At least, actually, there's different ways of doing sequent calculus proofs. I've given you a particular one. You only need to understand this particular one. So you may not, I'd be very, very surprised if you had much facility for doing it in detail, but that comes with practice. You just have to keep doing a few examples. Practice, 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 and this becomes very easy to do. It's not as challenging as it might seem at first glance. Simply building these proof trees is a very good way of understanding the proof rules themselves. Oh, by the way, I should say, I'll mention a little bit more about things connected with exams much later in the course. But just so you don't get scared, I'm never going to ask you to remember in an exam a set of proof rules. That would be completely pointless. I want you to understand how to apply proof rules, not to remember what they are. Okay, so don't worry about somehow internalizing the rules themselves. Do get practice in the process of being able to apply them. Question?
Yes. Could we prove this exact expression with the truth table?
Yes, indeed, you could. What you would do would be your expression would be, have a go. Your expression would be this one. Where's that? I guess you probably maybe already figured out what the expression is that you want to prove. You would have B implies C implies A, or B implies A. Right. So, I just want to say a little bit about proof strategy. There's two reasons for mentioning this. One is because it's kind of a feature of having these kind of proof rules. Because I've got a set of proof rules now, it's not just kind of some amorphous truth table. I can talk to you pretty directly about the strategy that you can use for applying these. Right? You know the general way of doing proof. It's taking the thing you want to prove, applying the proof rules in a tree-structured way, such that you always end up in these trivial proofs at the leaves of the tree. My trees grow downwards, so they're kind of funny downward-pointing trees. And so because you've got that, you can talk about strategy. The other reason for talking about strategy now is just to explain to you that although there's lots of choices every time you have to do one of these proofs, There is a kind of standard way you can approach it. So here's the way I recommend. Try that first, because that wins. Then you've got nothing to do. Always go for the line of least resistance, right? So if that works, you're done, obviously. So that's a good one to always consider first. Quite often, the syntax of the expression helps you. If it's an and, then that's the obvious one. If it's an or, these guys are the obvious ones, right? If it's an implication, this guy's an obvious one to try. Otherwise, you're in this sort of territory. And that's kind of harder to choose which one of those it might be to apply, because you haven't got any syntactic structure on the terms. Now, that doesn't mean that it's always going to be the case that when it's an implication that you're going to use only this one, because actually, that might be an implication. That could be an implication. That could be an implication, because obviously these things can be any structure at all. Or indeed, it can be an atomic proposition. So it's not the case that this is, no, it's if and only if here. It's not only that choice. But this is a good heuristic to use for trying to pick things. People who build systems that automatically do theorem proving using systems like this often have heuristics in them like this to help you guide how to do the proof process. But we won't go there. Okay. That's it. That's it talking about natural deduction proofs for now. You'll get plenty of practice later in your tutorials. Let's get on to the actual problem. So here we got database join. Remember database join? Employee, lecturer, here are the two database tables. Let's do what we normally do. We formalize it first. So I'm going to turn it into something, in this case in the predicate calculus. So I'm going out into the predicate calculus now from propositional logic. So one way of formalizing this table is to say, okay, employee is going to be the predicate name, and then we'll have an argument for each one of the columns in the table. So here's the name, here's the ID, employee, Dave, 2345. Right? Happy about that? All I'm doing is taking the table, and here's the table, and here's the name of the table. Right. So it's just a representational change. Same for lecture. There you go. So now I've got exactly the same information but expressed in my formal language. If I wanted to, I could add more information. I don't really need this for solving the problem, actually, but I'll give you it anyway. I could say things about this table. I could say things like, if I've got an employee with some N and some I, whatever the employee is, then N must be a name and the ID must be an I. Actually, people often do this with databases. And they provide metadata that tells you things about the elements that you appear in the table. Actually, well, I was talking about semantic web stuff before, and also with people who do database schema work describing tables. That's an important thing that people do. Then you can know what's inside the table without looking at the contents in some sense. So if I can't see this about the table, but I can see this, I can know something about how an employee is described. So logic can be useful for things like that. Same here. Okay, I could do the same thing here. I'm actually not going to need that information. I won't need these two axioms to actually solve the problem, but I will need to use some of this terminology. So now I've got this. I'm now in my formal world. I'm in the predicate calculus world. And now I'm going to describe how I get my new database. So employee is in one of the old databases, lecturer is the other old database, and new is going to be my new database. Remember, my new database had to combine the previous one, so I'm going to say new has five elements, a name, sex, age, and the name and the identifier. Remember, those were the columns in my new database. And then I'm going to say I can construct one of these entries in my new database if this is true. Here's my lecturer database, NSA, and my a record in my employee database, employee N2I. Notice these are two different N's, although I'm going to make them now be the same. So N1 equals N2. And A, the age, is less than 50. Remember, that was my other constraint when I was describing the problem, right? So that's the axiom that I now define. And then all I need to do now is to say, okay, I can conclude this given that this can be satisfied from these other axioms. Think of this as being, this is one axiom, and this is a whole lot of other axioms that has just given me trivial, well, not trivial information, just factual information about the databases. And if I apply deduction to this exhaustively, so I see how many instances for new I can calculate, then you're just going to have to trust me on this, because I'm just going to tell you, I get these two. So the number of instances of this that I can satisfy from these axioms are exactly these two. You can work it out yourself just by looking, if you like, and checking the constraints. There are only two people who have the same name in both databases and are under 50. It's Dave and Mary, because Ken doesn't appear in both, and Phil is way over 50. Right? Happy with that one. Okay.
I don't understand why you need two name entries in the new database.
You don't. I actually put them in just to be able to say this. I've got the N1 and the N2, and to show that they're there. If you want them with only one, you just exclude whichever one. Doesn't matter, because I've said they're the same. But it's a good question. You don't have to have it. In fact, you can have anything you want in here that's a variable inside here. Depends on which database you want to extract from the other ones. Actually, this is a lovely way, and in fact, a generic way of describing exactly how you want to generate a new database from old ones. Okay, happy with that one? Last one, and then you get to go out in the sunshine. There's the new table. English grammar. I think this one is a little bit more complicated, so don't worry if this gets a little bit kind of outer space-ish. It's an example. You don't have to memorize it or anything. Here are my grammar rules. Remember the grammar? With sentences and noun phrases and verb phrases. Here's another way of looking at that grammar. I thought I'd do it. There's different ways I could explain this. I'm deliberately doing it this way because I know most of you are doing functional programming. So I thought I'd describe this in a functional way, just because that's going to connect. So suppose I want to describe these guys as functions. Okay, let's describe them as functions. I'd say a sentence is the concatenation of a noun phrase with a verb phrase. So these guys are acting like functions, and the sentence function is going to concatenate a noun phrase with a verb phrase. A noun phrase is a function that's either going to be the result of a noun, or it's going to be the concatenation of a determiner with a noun. So it's a function that has an or in it. A verb phrase is either a verb, the result of a verb, or the result of concatenating a verb with a noun phrase. And then a noun is either going to give me the sequence containing one element, Dave, or it's going to give me the sequence containing one element, dust. So these square brackets are sequences. A verb gives me one element, bytes, in my very, very limited vocabulary. And a determiner gives me one element, the. Happy with that. Know enough about functional programming and so on to look at that and say, oh yes, indeed those are functions, but written in a funny way. Mm.
If you say that noun phrase is noun or concatenation, mm-hmm. It can be both. Isn't that a problem?
It could be both, but you can choose which one. But it's not both at the same time.
That bar means.
If I say, if I say that, I don't mean that x equals at the same time a or b. I mean that x equals a or x equals b, and I just have equal choice over those two. I don't mean they're simultaneously the same variable, because that's not possible. But I agree that is a little bit confusing, because an or, the reason why I'm always very careful when I talk about logical ors like the one I've got, to say it can be one, this one, or the other one, or possibly both, is because there is another kind of or that people often use, which is exclusive or. An exclusive or means it can be one or the other, but never can you get the same, that never could, they could never both be accessed. Sorry.
In that example you used, couldn't you have a case where it's technically both, where you have x equals a and then a equals b?
Yeah, so you could have, it's possible for both instances to be true. So it's possible, when I write something like this, it could be that for the proofs that I want to do, x could be a, x could be b, I can choose either one, but I can't have the variable x be bound to both. X can only be bound to one or the other, for which I have to make a choice at some point. It's just that I could choose the other way and that would be equally legitimate. It's not true that if I find out that x is a, it could never be b, which would be exclusive or. Right? In a way, what's the easiest way to think about this? Easiest way to think about it is it's completely free choice, including allowing you to choose both, but you can't choose them both to be the same thing, because x can't be both a and b at the same in the same proof. You can't bind this variable to be both A and B. You have to make a choice. But the choice is yours to make, which is with me. You're getting the swing of it. Okay? Right. So here's the functional bit of it. So just to do the or again, because that causes it a little... So take the noun, for example. So the noun is going to give you either Dave... or dust, not both at the same time, but you could have either one. Right. Okay, now let's turn this into logic. So I've turned each one of these functions just into an implication, and I've done the standard trick that people do when they go from functional languages into relational languages, logical languages like this one. I added an extra argument that's representing the output for the function. Actually, this is quite nice for you if you're doing functional programming and you're thinking, I'm sure not many of you are thinking, but now you will think, what's the relationship between functional languages and logical languages like the ones that we're using? And one relationship, not the only one, is via this root. So you added an extra argument to your predicate that's representing the output of the function. And then what would have been the definition that you use in the body of your function turns into a precondition for your axiom, the left-hand side of the implication. So if this is true, it implies this. And here's the output of what was the function. So I say I can generate a sentence, and the sequence is going to be S if I have a noun phrase F1 and a verb phrase S2. And C is the concatenation operation. So I concatenate S1 to S2 to get S. That's just taking two sequences and joining them end to end. I don't need to write that down for you. Okay, and that's just what that says, but this says it's functional. Yeah? So I'm not seeing here, I don't see the S, and I don't see the S1 and the S2, because they're just kind of hidden there in the function. Here's noun phrase, it's generating what it generates. Here's verb phrase, it generates what it generates. Those two things are concatenated together to generate what it generates, and that's what this generates. I said a lot of generates, but you get the idea. And this is doing the same. Here's the S. This guy generates S1, this guy generates S2, this concatenates them together to get S. Bingo. Right? And here's an or, right? So this says, I got a noun phrase, S, if it's a noun, S. Or, it could be a determiner, S1, a noun, S2, and concatenate S1 and S2 to get S. Those are two choices. Those are two ways that I can generate S. I can choose either one, and actually maybe both apply, and then I get two different S's. Or maybe I would even get two the same S's. It should be different ways that I could apply it, right? And they may both be true. Hey, that's good. That's why I prefer logic programming to functional programming. Actually, so it gives you a lot. It's got when you actually work with this stuff, it feels a lot more kind of flexible like that. And then here are the simple ones: Dave is a noun, and bytes is a verb, and so on and so forth. And then Given this bunch of grammar rules, here's how I can construct my proof tree. Okay? That is a determiner, dust is a noun. I can concatenate the to dust to get